You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Season 1, Episode 1 of the Site Bites Podcast, Canyon of Contention, where we go in-depth on prominent archaeological landscapes. I am your host, Carlton Gover, and I am joined by this season's featured co-host, Robert Weiner. For the topic of this episode, What is Chaco? Location, Features, and Chronology, we have the pleasure of having Rich Friedman with us as our guest this morning. Thank you so much for being on, Rich. It is a pleasure to have you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's another wonderful day.
Beautiful. Well, Rich, we're so happy to have you here with us and to talk about a place you and I both love so much, Chaco Canyon. So we were wondering if we could start off with you just introducing yourself a little bit and telling us, what is your connection to Chaco Canyon, both professionally and personally? How did you get introduced to archaeology of that region, and what does it mean to you?
That's a long question. Well, of course, my name's Rich Friedman. Oh, Chaco, my first time to Chaco was in the mid-1980s, and I went there in a VW bus. So yeah, that gives you an idea how long ago it was. That was with my sister and brother-in-law. They lived in Tohatchee, which is on the Navajo Reservation. And I went down for a visit, and we went out to Chaco. And to say I was impressed is, you know, kind of an understatement. And if fast forward five years later, I ended up in Chaco, or not in Chaco, in Tohatchee myself. That just kind of sealed the deal for me. We were going to be in New Mexico for just a few years. I grew up in Colorado and ended up in Tohatchee, which there's cultural resources all, you know, all over the place. The Chaco, greater Chacoan world is that's right in it. We went out to Chaco again, and, you know, I saw the exhibit there on the roads, and I thought, roads, I can find those, because my background's actually in geology. So I started looking for roads, and I was finding roads and great houses in the Tohatchee area. And one thing led to another. I finally ended up meeting John Stein, and which, you know, he's pretty big in Chaco and we're pretty big in roads as well. And after a few years, we ended up working professionally together. And I've spent a lot more time in Chaco than I ever thought I would, but it is truly a fascinating place, not only Chaco itself, but the greater Chacoan world. And to me, that's really the most impressive part of Chaco, is this larger region that everything moved in lockstep with Chaco. I mean, when one thing changes in Chaco, it's changing everywhere. Of course, it could be it's changing somewhere else. And the reflection is you see it in Chaco as well, but you've got this huge region, and depending on who you talk to, you know, it's from, I don't know, 70 to 90,000 square miles. It's just this huge region where everybody's doing the same thing at the same time. It started off with the roads and around Tohatchee, and just grew to where I actually got to work in Chaco a lot, and outside of Chaco too. So working inside and outside, inside the park itself, and then in the greater Chacoan region, really gave me a different perspective on Chaco than had I just worked in one place or the other.
Excellent. So did visiting Chaco during this experience that you just talked about, was that your first introduction to archaeology, or had you already been an undergraduate or gotten a couple degrees in anthropology prior to this experience? Like what inspired you to pursue a career in archaeology?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. So growing up, I was always interested in archaeology. I think the way Winston Hurst, who's an archaeologist in Blanding, Utah, one of the top archaeologists in southeastern Utah, the way he puts it, he says, you know, archaeology, you don't choose to go into archaeology. It just kind of does itself to you. And that's kind of what happened with me. When I went to college, I was interested in archaeology, but at that time, which was, you know, the mid-70s, mid to late 70s, if you didn't get a job, you know, as a professor at a university or a college, then you didn't get paid very much. And I like to eat, so I thought, I'll do something different. And I ended up getting a degree in geology. I was still really interested in archaeology. And after I got out of college, my first geology job was actually doing geothermal work, looking for geothermal resources in Nevada. And we're doing what's called geothermal gradient holes. So I was out there permitting site locations, getting site locations permitted. And one thing led to another again. And pretty soon the company I was working for realized I knew the archaeology probably as well as the archaeologists that were going out there. And for them, the big thing was I could go out and I could stake a hole where they wanted to do a put in a drill site and actually look for archaeology ahead of putting the stake in the ground and marking where we were going to drill, and also figure out if there was a clear access to that location. So I was doing pre-clearance work so that when we did hire the archaeologist to come in and do the clearance work, they didn't find anything. So that was my first, I guess you could call that professional archaeology. But yeah, it's just always been, I say an interest, some people would call it an obsession of mine. And so when I moved to New Mexico, it was so readily accessible that I ended up doing archaeology. A lot of it was because I ended up in GIS, Geographic Information Systems. So I had the capability and access to resources with GIS, which this was early on in GIS when not many people had it. I could use that in archaeology and do things that, you know, especially when you're working with a big region or big sites like you've got with Chaco, these huge buildings or this large region, the GIS just works so much better than prior to that. Everything was done in the analog world and on paper maps. So it really gave us the chance, us meaning John Stein and Taft Blackhorse and I, a chance to do things that hadn't been done before in ways that hadn't been done before. And so one thing led to another. And yeah, I don't have a degree in archaeology. It's in geology. And I do use those skills a lot in archaeology, though. That helps a lot understanding what should be natural and what is cultural. So yeah, that's how I ended up in archaeology.
And I think that's a testament to the interdisciplinary nature of archaeology, right? That you back in the day, not so long ago, that megafauna were roaming around New Mexico, but maybe back in the days of the 70s, that you're able to use your experience as a geologist to provide different frameworks and methods for expanding archaeological knowledge. And that's just, you know, fascinating and a testament to some of these early endeavors that were pursued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely an interdisciplinary science where the more people you've got with varied skill sets, quite often the better you can do with any sort of project in archaeology, because it does take those different skill sets.
One of the things that has been so awesome working with Rich over the years is that he was way ahead of the curve with a lot of the digital technologies that today are taken for granted. So as he was mentioning earlier, I mean, using GIS, can we say before it was cool? And I mean, Rich, you know, pioneered a LIDAR study of Chaco back in 2010, way before it was, you know, all over National Geographic. And maybe you guys were even using it before that. I don't know. So with these digital technologies, what has been the benefit of bringing them to archaeology? What was it like at that time when these weren't common technologies? What was the real benefit of bringing GIS and more digital methods to the field of Chaco and archaeology?
One of the biggest benefits was to be able to combine new work with old work, primarily, you know, maps, but also taking tabular or textual data and transposing that into databases within the GIS so that you could begin to look at associations and see the big picture. So prior to that, everything in the analog world, you might have some aerial photos at say 1 to 40,000 scale, some at 1 to 20 and some at 1 to 8. And that none of them were at the same scale. So working on those aerial photos at the same time was really difficult, where with the GIS, we were able to scan them and then georeference them and then have them all in the same spatial framework and you could begin to work through the different years of aerial photos to look for roads, for instance. So it really made it much easier to pick up on things that maybe otherwise were a bit too subtle. Plus, you know, once it's in the digital environment, you can enhance the photos. So you can make them lighter, darker. You can do histogram stretches on them. You can do all sorts of fun things that then begin to show you what you hadn't seen before. And it was in 1994, I was able to participate with NASA and the Getty Conservation Institute on a pilot program or a pilot project in Chaco Canyon, showing the value of these new digital technologies for cultural resource documentation and management. So we were able to get some airborne multispectral data of Chaco, which had data that of that resolution at that time was pretty rare. It was 3 meter and 3 meter data was what it was, flown in a Learjet. But you know, for 94, that was huge. You just didn't find multispectral data anything under 10 meter or 30 meter resolution at that time. So 3 meter resolution was pretty amazing, and that allowed us to work with the multispectral data and kind of figure out what was going on with that. Would it work or would it not work? So that was a huge plus. And so working on it early, it gave us a chance to see how digital technologies would help, and they allow you to put together a big picture from pieces here and there.
Let's talk a little more about that big picture. So tell us a little bit about, you know, we've heard now about Chaco and a little bit of its location in your previous work, but let's hear about what is Chaco and where is it located, and tell us a little bit of background about this site you've worked on for so many years. And as you've showed me, Chaco is not just the canyon.
Yeah, what is Chaco? Chaco is, that most people think of it as the canyon, as the park, and it has a fairly narrow time span. So, you know, what most people think is that narrow time span. When you begin to look at Chaco in this greater Chacoan region, you see things you see in Chaco. You see the great houses. But you see the roads as well, and you see that the roads begin actually a lot earlier than what we think of as the great houses. It looks like the roads are beginning somewhere around 600 AD, give or take, 50 to 100 years. And they show up about the same time you see the first form of public architecture in this greater Chacoan region, which you see in Chaco too, which is the Great Kiva or in Basket Maker Three Times, that would be the Great Pit Structure. So you've got this prototypical public architecture or a building or a structure that is larger than what is expected for a normal domestic structure. And then you've got roads going to that. And that just continues to develop through time. And you see this scenario where things are, I don't like to use the word evolve, because that places a stigma on us that, you know, people are learning to do something and they're improving. It's not really an evolution. It's more at just a change through time. There, I think there are definite conscious choices. We aren't gonna live in this pit house anymore. We're gonna build these structures behind it, or we aren't gonna make just pit houses. We're gonna make structures behind it, and then we're gonna make even bigger structures. We aren't gonna do this waddle and daub thing anymore. We're gonna do masonry, and this plays out through the entire region, and it looks very conscious in the way it's done, because if it wasn't a conscious cultural choice, it would be, you'd see a definite lag of a significant period once you get to the outer reaches, you know, wherever it starts, say the one thing starts in Chaco going from waddle and daub to masonry, then you'd see it in Eastern Arizona, maybe 50 years later. So you'd see an obvious change there, a separation in time, and you don't see that obvious change. So it looks like throughout this entire region, the people of Chaco, of this greater Chacoan world, are doing the same thing at the same time. And you see that with the pottery styles. You can tell where different pieces of pottery come from, but the styles typically are very similar. Sometimes there's a slight stylistic change where elements are bolder or narrower, finer work, but the general style is all the same. And again, that changes throughout the region at the same time. And if it was just people doing, you know, things on an evolutionary basis, then you'd see that evolve at different locations at different times, instead of everybody throughout this entire region going, okay, it's time to make Chaco black on white, and everybody does it. So Chaco itself is this larger system, some sort of, it's a cultural identity, could be different language groups, different cultural background groups, you know, coming together to create this thing that we look at as Chaco as a whole. And they're doing the same thing at the same time. So they have a identity that's the same throughout this entire region. And they're playing it out from at least late Basket Maker 3, probably earlier than that, all the way through to the end of Pueblo 3 or the 1300s. So it's several hundred years of people doing the same thing over this whole region. And you see some ebbs and flows along the, I typically call it the frontier, where, you know, you're on the edge of this greater Chacoan world, and things will be a little less rigid in those areas. But once you get more toward the interior, you know, 50 miles or so from that furthest frontier, everything's going to look pretty much exactly the same throughout the entire region.
Well, excellent. Well, we're going to take this time for me and Rob to make a stylistic change to get ready for segment two. We'll be right back with Rich Friedman.
Welcome back to episode one of the Site Bites podcast. We're here with Rich Friedman. Rich, can you tell us a little bit about the environmental setting of Chaco and what it's like in the surrounding region?
Oh, yeah. Chaco is, it's in the San Juan Basin. It's very close to the structural center of the San Juan Basin. And it's also kind of in the place you really wouldn't want to be to live. I mean, the Chaco itself is a pretty harsh environment. The temperature swings. I mean, in the summertime, it can easily get over 100 degrees, quite often up in the mid to upper 90s for, you know, long periods of time. But in the winters, it can drop down to below 40, below zero. So it has it's a challenging environment, definitely, as far as its climate goes, because it's getting drainage off the continental divide, meaning the cold air kind of settles down in the valley or the canyon there. And so you get it's 40 degree temperature changes in a day are common. So if it's 60 during the day, it will drop below freezing at night, which creates a difficult situation for agriculture, because you have a very short growing season. Even though it seems like it should be longer, it's really very short because of these huge temperature fluctuations the canyon gets. The soils there are pretty unfriendly to high agricultural production, mainly because there's a lot of salts and a lot of clay in the soils. That's because of the geology of Chaco. It's sitting in the Cretaceous sandstone and shales, and those shales they create badlands. So the Bisti Badlands, you know, most of your badlands you see around, which are, you know, they're huge, large expanses of shale exposure. So underneath the sandstone in Chaco Canyon is this shale that is not very good at growing things. And that's kind of true of the whole center of the basin, where it's not real good. Now, there are little microclimates where you can grow things, and you can grow things really well. And the side canyons, the little tributaries to the Chaco, are typically areas where you can grow pretty well. You're getting water that isn't quite so high in salt, doing better as far as salt and easier to control than the Chaco when the Chaco flows. Controlling it would be really, really difficult. So the side canyons really, they look like places where people could live. And then you get out on the periphery of the San Juan Basin. So you're up against the Chuscas to the west. Things look really good. You actually have streams that are, or were, now they're pretty dry, but 30 years ago, you had streams that were actually perennial. They'd flow year round coming out of the Chuscas. They didn't go far out into the valley. They dry up, but you did get water for most of the year. Tohatchee Wash, there's a stream there that flows most of the year. It might dry up just before the monsoon season hits in July, August, but it flows most of the year. And the same with the Captain Tom Wash up by Newcomb, Sinosti Wash. So you've got these washes coming off the Chuscas that are flowing year-round. And subsequently, you've got modern-day agriculture that we're pretty sure was the same thing going on 1,000 years ago. You had a lot of agriculture in those areas because there's just more water available, and it's a better area to live. And the temperature is much different there. You don't get the big temperature swings along the Chusca Slope or down along Lobo Mesa that you get in the canyon itself. The temperature swings are slightly lower. You don't get as cold. You don't get quite as hot. It's just the environment is more suitable to living and growing agriculture there. I first noticed these differences when I was living in Tohatchee on the reservation, on the Navajo reservation. I was working in Gallup, and Gallup is very similar to Chaco in its setting. It gets cold air drainage off of the Continental Divide to the east, just like Chaco does. And it has virtually the same temperature every day and the same temperature swings. And when I was living in Tohatchee and commuting to Gallup to work, I saw this difference here where, it'd be nice in Tohatchee. There might be some rain or light snow in Tohatchee. By the time I got to Gallup, there'd be, 6 inches to a foot of snow, and it was just a totally different environment. And then when I lived there, I realized what was going on. It was just, it had these huge temperature swings that changed what the environment was like. And in that valley that Gallup's in, the Rio Parco Valley, you saw the same thing that you do in Chaco. There was not a lot of agricultural production in that drainage itself, that main drainage, the little tributaries off of it. Yeah, you get a lot of agricultural production. It's very similar in environment there. And Chaco is just, when I think of Chaco, it's not the place I would think to go have a great civilization. It's a harsh environment. It's a difficult environment. And you go 40 miles away from Chaco in any direction, and you've got a much better environment to live in. So that's probably one of the big things, is why did they even select Chaco to build the center of this greater cultural influence throughout the Four Corners area?
And there are no trees in Chaco. It's not just the lack of rainfall and the qualities of the soil. Tell us about the lack of trees, and not only for heating, but for construction too.
Yeah, the trees in Chaco just, they don't exist. And again, that's for something, a location in its geologic and environmental setting. No trees is what you would expect. Shale isn't really good for growing big trees. Most of the trees in Chaco grow up where it's sandier along the cliffs or on top of the mesas there. And you don't get ponderosa pine, which you see a lot of ponderosa pine in the buildings, or larger pinyon pine. That doesn't exist. You get junipers, some pinyon, but a lot of juniper, and nothing down in the valley. So the construction timbers, for a long time, there is a big debate that there might be some remnant Pleistocene forest in Chaco, which, looking at it, with my geologist eyes, it's like, no, that probably never happened. And more recently, it's been proven that, that most of the timber in Chaco, like almost all of it, came from outside the canyon, at least 40 miles, some of it 60, 65 miles away. So they are hauling the timber for construction of Chaco into Chaco. And then with this lack of wood in Chaco, when you look at population estimates, you have to also look at the availability of fuel for fires for heating and cooking. And again, because most of the available wood there that is there today is up on the mesas, you're going to have to be hiking up on top of the mesas to get wood for everyday living. So, you know, if you just say one tree per person per year for heating and cooking, which is, I think that's an ultra conservative estimate, 3,000 people in the canyon, you'd have to have 3,000 trees a year. And 3,000 trees a year for over 100 years is a lot of trees, 300,000 trees. So when you begin to look at that and look at the environment of Chaco itself, you see these big buildings, you begin to go, well, and very few fire hearths in the big buildings. At least to me, it becomes apparent that these large buildings are not huge apartment complexes. They're huge temples, palaces. They're places where important people live, because there is some living going on there, but not where everybody did. So then we go back to playing the game of, you know, monumental architecture. And then we've got monumental architecture in an area that really isn't easily inhabitable, which makes Chaco even more interesting, I think. And that's part of what draws people to Chaco, is this mystery of it's in this harsh environment, yet you have this monumental architecture sitting in the middle of a harsh environment. So that's one of the big draws to Chaco, I think.
So you've touched on a couple other subjects already, including architecture and some of these features. Could you give us like a brief, you know, overview of the site construction of Chaco? What periods do we first see some settlement? Like, are people in here, you know, during Clovis, and we can see like continual occupation up till today? Basically, just through chronology, how do we see Chaco change over time?
Yeah, so the first, as far as I know, the first inhabitation in Chaco is during the Archaic. We haven't found any paleo sites in Chaco, although there are paleo sites in the San Juan Basin, so probably are there. There are archaic sites, and they'd be mid to late archaic, 6,000 to 4,000 years BCE. So we do get those. They're primarily cave sites. You go just north of Chaco, you get a lot of sites in sand dunes that are north of Chaco. So yeah, we've got Bajada and Pinto Basin. There is some Pinto Basin, so we are getting into paleo. I've seen Pinto Basin sites in Chaco. And then you really begin to see more sites, you know, more evidence of use of Chaco in late Basket Maker 2 into Basket Maker 3. So that's, and depending on who you talk to, Basket Maker 3 will be around, you know, 5 to 700 AD. It might be 350 to 750. It changes depending on who's citing it, but you can think generally 500 to 700 is Basket Maker 3, and that's when the predominant domestic structure living site is a pit house. And normally it's a fairly shallow pit house, but not as you get closer to the 700s, they tend to drop or get deeper, so you do get some pretty deep pit houses post 600 AD. And then you go to P1 or Pueblo 1, which is 7,750-ish to 9,950, depending on who you talk to. And during that time frame, you still have the pit structure, the pit house, only now it may be what we're calling in later times the kiva. It may still be a domestic structure. It looks like it probably is. It's still a domestic structure. So people are still living in the pit house, but you've got typically a row of rooms, a series of above grade rooms behind that pit structure. And the construction of those rooms is usually a mud adobe wood construction that's known as wadden daub, where it's not really masonry stacked up. You've just got kind of like a wood fence with adobe plastered on it, and then a roof on top of that. So it's a pretty rudimentary structure. As you get Mid P1 is when you start seeing more masonry elements. So you'll get single course masonry walls where you've got just rocks stacked on top of each other and still kind of doing the waddle and daub thing. You'll have quite often wood posts in those walls to make them a little sturdier. By around 825 to 850, you start seeing in Chaco itself, that's when Pueblo Bonito, the first official, what you recognize as being Pueblo Bonito now, structure shows up there. And that's the first multi-story structure in Chaco Canyon. Well, Pueblo Bonito, Una Vida, Peñasco Blanco are believed to be the early structures. So around before we're out of this P1 period, we've got these structures that have single course masonry, sometimes double course, and are at one to two stories in height. So we've got multiple stories. Then as you go on, you know, from 900 to 1100, 1150 is P2, or that's kind of the fluorescence of Chaco. That's the classic Chaco period that everybody thinks of. That's when the grade houses get really big. So during that time is when you get all the massive construction in Chaco, and most of it's toward the end of that time. So in the 1000 to around 1115, 1120 is when you get all the massive building in Chaco. And those are really big structures, really big walls. The typically they're core veneer walls, which mean you've got this inner core in the wall that's kind of a rubble mortar mix, and then this nicely built veneer on the outside that makes the wall look really nice. And is, you know, typically that's what we think of when we think of Chaco, is this core veneer masonry. Some of these walls, you know, at the base of the walls, they can be 3.5 feet thick, and they go up, the tallest one is around 40 feet. So you've got these structures that are just huge. Toward the end of the period, early on, you know, in the 800s, in Bonito, the rooms are around 2 meters tall. And by the time you get to the end of the building, the big construction stages in Bonito, you're looking at rooms that are a little bit under 4 meters tall, so about 12 feet. So they're getting really tall. Again, that's another thing that we're thinking. That's more a monumental type architecture. That's not something that your average subsistence farmer is going to build a room that's 25 feet by 20 feet by 12 feet tall. That's way beyond what your average subsistence farmer would ever need. And so you've got hundreds of rooms that size in Chaco. So that's why we think, you know, this period is when you're building all the big monumental architecture in Chaco. Then 1100 to 1300, which is P3, or 1150 to 13, you don't see the massive building in Chaco anymore. It pretty much dies off. There's still people there. Occupation is still pretty good. You just don't see these big construction stages in Chaco. The big construction during that time period happens throughout the larger region. You get some really big structures. Chaco, it seems like the big construction there has stopped, but the use of Chaco hasn't stopped. So if we're using construction as a proxy for habitation, then nobody's living there, but people are living there. It's just for some reason the big construction has stopped then, and it's happening elsewhere throughout this region where we're getting buildings the same size as Pueblo Bonito being built outside of Chaco.
Well, excellent. Thank you for that brief overview, Rich. And with that, the chronology for this segment has ended. So we're going to move on to the next period of this podcast right after this.
Welcome back to episode one of the Site Bites podcast. This is Rob Weiner. We are talking with Rich Friedman. Rich, we want to hear about some of your recent work in Chaco. Tell us about mapping Pueblo Bonito and how that led to the model that people can see in the visitor center.
Oh, yeah. Mapping Pueblo Bonito was, it's something I've been doing for years. I have several different iterations of the map, but the most recent one, the park needed a model for the new museum exhibit, which is a model of Pueblo Bonito, and they wanted it circa 1940 before Threatening Rock fell and took, you know, part of Bonito out. It fell on top of part of Pueblo Bonito. So they wanted, you know, to be able to show the walls the way they look, the heights of the walls in ruin, not a reconstruction of the site the way it looked when people were there, you know, before it started to fall down, but the way it looked in 41 as an excavated ruin. So I went out with, I used two different poles. One was a 16-foot pole. The other was a 23-foot pole with cameras mounted on this pole. And you used photogrammetry, which is the measurement of things through photos. So I used a new structure from motion type of photogrammetry with literally thousands of photos that I took with these cameras on these poles of Pueblo Bonito to recreate a model, a 3D model, and a new map of Pueblo Bonito. And that map had the elevations of the walls every 6 inches. So think of a contour, elevation contour map only just on the walls, so that the contractor who built the model could create an accurate model of the way Pueblo Bonito looked in 1941. And I used, you know, technology for that. You can think if you've ever been there or you look at some of the photos, it's a big site. It's about 3 acres. And I mapped that all by myself with the cameras and GPS. I used GPS to get accurate, survey grade GPS to get accurate positioning on everything, and created a 3D model to do that. So yeah, technology is, that's a case of, without using photogrammetry, there's no way one person could have mapped that. I think I spent 6 days in the field doing that. And one person could never have done that in 6 days. A group of three people, you know, a survey crew couldn't do that in 6 days. That would be months of work. So technology is really it's a great thing, and something that I think for archaeology, we're only hitting the tip of the iceberg on what it's going to do for us.
Absolutely fantastic, Rich. Yeah. To everybody listening, if you haven't been to the visitor center at Chaco, I highly recommend checking out this model because it is awesome. I also want to say I love the image of you out there with the 16-foot pole and tourists walking through the site and say, what is this guy doing? Love it. So tell us a little bit about use of LIDAR. You were really ahead of the curve using that technology. So how have you used LIDAR in research on Chaco Canyon and Chacoan roads? And what has it taught you? What has it revealed?
Oh, yeah. LIDAR is, when it comes to roads, LIDAR is really a extremely valuable tool, or invaluable tool. I first used it in, 2001? Yeah, 2001 was the first time I used LIDAR in Chaco. We got LIDAR flown the real target was Pueblo del Arroyo and Alto were two of the targets in Peñasco Blanco. We wanted to see several things. Part of it was erosion mapping, and part of it was to look at what we could do with the roads. That's why we did Pueblo Alto. And just like we expected, the roads showed up real clearly. And this is when LIDAR was still a pretty new technology. It had come out in the mid-1990s. And getting real, real high-resolution data was pretty tough. But the roads, even at that time with that data, showed up real clearly. Then, you know, fast forward to 2007, got some more LIDAR, not of Chaco, but the greater Chaco region up near Farmington in the Farmington area. Aztec Ruins was a part of that big data acquisition. And we could see the North Road going out of Aztec Ruins just clear as a bell, which it was one of those things that for years was kind of controversial because it didn't really show up super clear on any aerial photography except for the 1930s aerial photography, which we didn't have access to until recently. And the LIDAR, it just showed that road up clear as a bell. And another road called it's the Aztec Airport Road, which is a 20-meter wide road going up toward the Aztec Airport that it's hard to see today. It was clear in 1919, but the LIDAR makes it. You can measure the new profiles on it. So LIDAR is a huge, huge thing with roads because they are these linear features that go across the landscape. Think of them kind of like a linear trough. And you can use in the computer environment, we can make the sun come up and go down anywhere we want. So we can make the sun come up, say at in the north, and just barely shed light on your LiDAR image, your 3D image, and it will create this shadow enhancement of a linear feature running east-west. So LiDAR is really a good thing to use with roads because they're pretty subtle anyway. And when you can shadow enhance that linear expression or topographic expression on the surface of the earth, it really helps identify where roads are.
Yeah, it's been, I know, incredibly helpful in the collaborations we've had together to use LiDAR and see new roads and to create a measurement of them too. And as the fact that they're going away, we have a digital record of as they exist now, which is just a really great asset. Rich, I also want to ask you about the 3D modeling you've done of some of the Chaco and Great Houses, which again is unique, I would say, within Chaco research, Chaco studies. Why do you think it's important to see the buildings in 3D?
I think what seeing the buildings in 3D and scaled buildings accurate as we can make them based on the archaeological record, it helps us understand, number one, what they look like. Number two, just how big they are. And number three, it gives us an experience that we can't have in the real world. So the virtual world gives us this experience of what these buildings might have felt like at the time they were, you know, fully constructed and what it might have felt like being there. It's been an interest of mine because in my mind, when I look at the buildings, I extrude them, but conveying that to somebody else has always been difficult, where if you can put it into the 3D environment and make these virtual reconstructions, then other people can see the same thing that you're seeing in your mind. Plus, sometimes by going through this process of reconstructing them, you see things that you didn't see before, or things look different than you thought they did. So it really is a real valuable exercise to go through to help understand not only what the building looked like, but how it was constructed and how it may have felt to be there at the time.
Excellent. Now, for the close of this, to sum all, you know, this episode up, what do you hope your legacy is going to be in terms of Chacoan archaeology and research?
Oh, that's, what do I hope my legacy will be? Well, I hope that people can see that I did contribute something to our greater understanding of what Chaco is, and that although, you know, I do often provide some interpretation of the data, I think what I want to be able to do is convey information to people so that they can make their own independent evaluation of Chaco and come up with their own conclusions. And if my legacy is just that I helped push the digital envelope on Chaco to understand and see Chaco better, put all this data that is Chaco, because it is so big, you know, it's so massive, not only the canyon itself, but this larger region, into a context to where it can be dealt with and understood at this large scale. And if my name is associated with that in any way, I think that would be an amazing legacy.
Well, I have no doubt your name will be associated with that, and that for years to come, people will be looking at your models and work with LiDAR as revealing an unknown extent and an previously unknown degree of detail from the Chaco world. So thank you for all you do, Rich. Where do you see Chaco research going? What do you think are the big remaining questions, and what sort of work do you see as important to the field moving forward?
Where is it going? Well, there are a lot of questions. There are probably more questions than there are answers when it comes to Chaco. I think, you know, we're beginning to see more use of digital technologies, of GIS, of remote sensing, helping to understand Chaco, helping to document. So I think that's one thing that we're going to see in the future. that will probably help us understand Chaco much better is the use of technologies, mainly because it's such a big area. I think the biggest questions still remaining, and there's still questions, is how many people lived in Chaco, kind of how was it organized, and who was there? And those are questions that in some cases I think are probably easy answers. As far as who was there, I don't know that that's an easy answer at all, other than I think all the current indigenous peoples in the greater Four Corners region were all participating in Chaco in some greater way. And maybe at some point we can understand a little bit better how that happened, how that participation with all these different groups happened. I think continued investigations into known oral histories is probably a real good thing, because there is a really, really valuable record on Chaco itself in the oral histories. Of course, some of that isn't necessarily accessible to the average person because it's oral histories that only the Native Americans know. But there are a lot of written histories that I think we can glean a lot of information from if we get past this idea of like the office rumor where things change. Once we all begin to understand how important the accuracy of these histories are to Native Americans, then I think we'll begin to be able to understand the stories that they've told us.
I think something else you've really helped me to understand, as you covered extensively in this episode, is that Chaco is not just the canyon. And for about a century now, a little over a century, we've had excavations in the canyon, visitors, visit the great houses in the national park of Chaco Culture National Historical Park. But really, there's 150, maybe 200 Chaco-related sites across this huge area, the size of Ohio, all across the Four Corners. And as you mentioned, that's all moving in unison with one another. The pottery styles change together. The architecture changes together. And that is a big cultural system. That is a big deal. And so to add to your thoughts, I also see Chaco research in the upcoming years beginning to look beyond just what's in the canyon and ask, what are these outliers? How are they related to what's happening in the center? Is this a united sort of something like an empire, civilization, or are these people, the other ideas people are emulating? So I think really beginning to see the bigger picture, see that Chaco is not just the canyon, is going to be an important step moving forward. And there's always new information. As you said, there's always new technologies. So there's a lot to look forward to.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. The greater world is, Chaco itself is really cool, but yeah, that greater world, when you begin to look at the greater world, it makes Chaco so much more than what it is when you just look at Chaco. So yeah, hopefully the greater world of Chaco will become a bigger focus. I think I was really lucky in that it's a chronology thing, the chronology of archaeology in the Southwest. So I got to work with a lot of people who worked at the Chaco Center, which was at UNM in Albuquerque. And so I've worked with what they called at the time, the Chaco insiders, the people who worked in the canyon. And I've worked with the Chaco outsiders, the people who worked outside the canyon. And I've worked both places. So I've been able to see this kind of this bigger Chacoan world. So yeah, if we can improve the visibility of that greater Chacoan world and understand that better, I think, that will be huge.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Rich. We've just interviewed Rich Friedman about background information on Chaco Canyon and its greater world, and he shared with us about his work utilizing emerging digital technologies. Thank you so much for listening to Site Bites, Episode 1 of Season 1, and be sure to tune in next when we are joined by Dr. Kathy Cameron, and we talk about the origins of Chaco. What would draw people to this harsh canyon to build on such a grandiose scale?
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.